Good afternoon and welcome to Open Air, KLW's weekly radio magazine of the performing arts. I'm your host, David LaTulipe. Today we'll hear from Jennifer Klutzel of the Cypress String Quartet, which is celebrating its 20th and final season here in San Francisco by offering some pop-up concerts. We'll also hear briefly about the Hill Barnes production of Sweet Charity, and about a new play at Z-Space receiving its world premiere, The Empty Nesters. I'll also have a conversation with Mark Gray, San Francisco native and composer of Frankenstein Symphony, which is being performed tonight by the Berkeley Symphony. Stay with us. The Cypress String Quartet, which is Cecily Ward on violin along with Tom Stone, Ethan Filner on viola, and Jennifer Klutzel on cello, announced recently that the ensemble will disband this summer after 20 years of performing together. A formal farewell concert will be presented by the Cypress at the Green Room of the War Memorial Building on June 26th. Cypress's impressive accomplishments include 17 years of call and response programming, nearly 40 commissions and premieres, and more than 15 commercially released albums, including this month's release of the full cycle of Beethoven's quartets, which they will present live in a series of pop-up concerts entitled Beethoven in the City. In all 11 districts of San Francisco, from St. Anthony's Dining Room to public parks to the Rotunda at City Hall, music lovers can enjoy these amazing works performed by the quartet as a loving tribute to their hometown. Jennifer Klutzel, cellist, joins me in studio to tell me more. She's a graduate of the Juilliard School and a Fulbright Grant winner. She's also appeared in concerts across the United States, Europe, and Asia, as well as with the quartet, and has appeared as a guest artist with the Chamber Music Society of Lincoln Center, among others, collaborated with the likes of Wuhan, Gary Hoffman, and Paul Neubauer. Jennifer, it's such a pleasure to have you in studio to talk about this really fun event.
Thanks, David. It's great to be here.
Well, first of all, you know, 20 years, was it a group decision? Did someone say, you know, we got to think about passing on, or what is our legacy going to be? We all have better things to do. What's the story there?
No, it was a group decision. Took a lot of thought, a lot of time, a lot of discussion. If you know anything about string quartets, you know they spend a lot of time talking about things, important decisions. So it took us a while.
It's a family issue, too.
It really is.
The time you spend together.
Yeah, we spent a lot of time. Three of us are founding members. And the new guy, Ethan, our violist, has been with us 15 years. So it's, you know, we've been doing this for a long time.
You still make him get the coffee, though?
We make him carry the CDs when we travel. Sorry, Ethan. He's a big guy. It's perfect for him. But it was something that we, you know, when we started out, we wanted to spend our time steeping ourselves in the great music of like Beethoven or Dvorak and Schubert and all these incredible works of art. And as we grew to realize that we were finishing up our Beethoven series, we recorded all 16 quartets and did our first cycle in Europe last year and began to feel the pull of like, what are we going to do next? Do we want to keep doing this for another 20 years? Because that's sort of, you know, you'd have to sort of settle in for the next set of projects. Or are we ready? You know, we're all young enough to go out and do another 20 years on something else. And I think that pull felt strong. It felt like a good time to say, okay, we're going to put an exclamation point on it. We're going to go out with a bang. People keep asking what I'm going to do next. And I say, I have two Beethoven cycles in front of me still. We just recorded the Brahms sextets last week. I don't have time to think about what comes next.
Well, good. That's a luxury to have. That's wonderful. How about the rest of the quartet? Have they made formal plans or shared with you what their plans
are?
Not
yet. We've talked about it a little bit, but I think everybody's just really focused on making sure that this you know, these final few months are really amazing and excellent. So
how long, I guess the Beethoven cycle would be considered like the marathon for string quartet.
It really is.
It's a benchmark. I mean, you record these quartets, they're iconic.
It is. And it took us, let's see, we started recording them in 2007, and we completed the early ones, the Opus 18s, last August. So it took us that amount of time. Although one of the very first pieces we sat down to learn together 20 years ago was a Beethoven quartet. So it's been, you know, not a week has gone by, not a month has gone by when we haven't been performing, recording, talking about, thinking about practicing some Beethoven. So even with everything else that we've done, that's been really a cornerstone of our work together.
There have been many quartets that have recorded the full cycles. Yeah. I'm wondering if you individually or as a group looked to some string quartets, ensembles of the past and the way that they approach the quartets?
Sure. Well, I think all of us come from a point of listening to many, many old recordings. And it actually, our first years together, we went to, we made a pilgrimage to London to work with the Amadeus Quartet. We are huge fans of theirs. The three remaining members that were alive then coached us in a lot of Beethoven and some other pieces as well. So I think we looked at that. You know, I don't, when I'm working on a piece of music, I only go to a recording of it after I've really got my own opinion about it. And then I pretend like the person on the recording is a teacher for me. I'm like, well, how did they choose to solve the problems that I've, you know, encountered with this? And so it's almost like somebody's talking to me from the past. Mm. You know, what did that cellist do? Did they take the repeats? Did they not? How did they, what kind of tempos did they choose?
Where did they place the bow?
Exactly. Now, we weren't in the studio when they were recording them, so I have no idea what discussions happened while they were making the recordings, and that's always important to remember. A recording is just a moment in time that's captured.
Right. Well, share with us some of those conversations that you had as a quartet went through the whole cycle.
Well, you mean...
Obviously about tempo and...
Right, about those things. Well, I mean, you know, when we're... rehearsing this music, it becomes so much more than just like, what tempo do we want? What, you know, it's more about what feeling is this? One of the things I love about Beethoven's music and why it's so rich and why you're able to spend 20 years in it is that every movement has a character. A different character. Beethoven never did the same thing twice. Now, you can kind of categorize them into certain types of music, but in each one, he's capturing something new and he's always pushing the envelope. And, you know, my joke is that Beethoven is laughing at me sometimes. I've practiced so much, and then I'm still struggling with it in some way, and it makes me laugh because I'm like, okay.
I'm performing the Beethoven Ninth Symphony with the Peninsula Symphony next week already on Piccolo, and it's just marvelous and fascinating to think of this man who was completely deaf by that time composing such an amazing piece of music. His quartets are divided into early, middle, and late.
That's right.
How many are there total?
There are 16. 16 quartets, and they really fit in the early, middle, and late periods like that. And actually, I just heard a performance of the Ninth last week, the Ninth Symphony. I hadn't heard one live in a long time, and I was really struck by the fact that that was written just before he turned back to string quartets, and then the rest of his life he spent writing the last five quartets.
Wow.
Which is amazing. So it was, and it was wonderful to, you know, draw those parallels to see how he approached the symphony as a, you know, it's incredible.
And that also informs us of the profundity of those last quartets.
Yes. It really was him pulling into himself more, I think, and going through a lot. They're only written in a few years' time, 1825 to 27 or something like that. But each one, you know, he was pushing the envelope on what to do with string quartets. So he took what Haydn and Mozart had done, and he said, okay, well, we have a four-movement form. That's pretty traditional for everything. Well, and so the first of his lates is in four movements. The second of the lates, he adds a fifth movement. The next one, six movements. With a great fugue at the end. It's crazy, you know, and had to be like separated out from that piece. The next piece, Opus 131, seven movements played without pause, C sharp minor. Crazy. I mean, he completely exploded the form. And then the final quartet he wrote, back to the four movements. Like he said, okay, I tried all that. I'm coming back to home base here.
Hmm. How much of a purist is the quartet in approaching the historic musicological aspect of the quartets? Did you look at some of the autographs, some of the sketchbooks?
Absolutely.
That kind of thing?
Absolutely. In our first cycle, when we were playing them in Europe, in Prague, Budapest, and Vienna, two of the concerts took place in the Lobkowitz palaces over there in Prague and Vienna. And the one in Vienna was where he premiered the Eroica Symphony, and they have collections of his music there that we went to see. And actually in the Lobkowitz Palace in Prague, we were performing the Opus 18 quartets 6 feet away from the original parts They were behind glass. But we could see Beethoven's handwriting correcting things. You know, he was making little corrections in the parts, and it's phenomenal.
Wow.
Felt real sense of history in that. So, yes, we did. And the amazing Beethoven Center down in San Jose, you know, we have...
I have no idea. What is
oh,
this?
Oh, my goodness. At San Jose State, or actually in the library that's associated with San Jose State, they have a collection, and it's one of the largest collections of Beethoven autographs, first editions, conversation books. It's where the hair is that they tested.
Oh, I heard. It's so funny. I heard about the hair, but
they have the death mask.
About that.
There's the death mask
wow.
there. They have a piano from his time period that you can hear performed.
I had no idea.
It's phenomenal, and you can go. You can take a tour. You can meet the people in charge there. They'll gently let you see some things. So we spent a lot of time there.
San Jose has been for me going down to play tennis with my buddy. So now I have a different reason for going
instead of
the opera as well.
Imagine that. You have Bonn, Germany. You have, all these places in Europe that have great Beethoven collections, and you have San Jose, California.
That's amazing. You just made my day. Thank you, Jennifer.
I'm so glad.
Now let's talk. Well, I also want to talk about your approach to the recordings.
Mm-hmm.
How... Were they all made in a studio? Were they made in a concert hall? How about the miking? I'm always curious looking again to the quartets of the past,
mm-hmm.
did you look at those types of techniques and decide this is the sound we want to get for the audio experience?
Well, we wanted to get the best sound, the most real sound we could get for sure.
From an audience's perspective or from each instrument's perspective, the way it's blended?
From the blend, I would say.
Okay.
From the performer's point of view, we would look to things of the past, but we have great equipment today. So we do all of our recordings up at Skywalker Sound in Marin County, and it's incredible up there. And it's when you perform there, it's like performing in a concert hall. They can change the sound of the room a lot. And although we tried it with many, many, many different microphones, we end up using just a pair of microphones further back there
mm-hmm.
because the blend sounds, we've worked on this craft of blending our sound together for 20 years. So we want to just have that captured and not an individual thing that you have to then blend in a studio later. We are trying to capture moments in time of how we feel about this music. The best performance of it, obviously. But the minute we leave the studio, I have new ideas about these pieces. The first thing I said to my colleagues when we finished recording the lights was, can we do them again?
I was going to say, do you ever have that regret after that final take is done? Do you what do they call it? Consumer regret?
No. I think that's the reality of what we do. It's a little bit like that, mandalas, that sand art or something. It kind of blows away. It's that performance is there, even when it's captured on a disc. It's just that moment in time.
That's a great analogy. I'm talking with Jennifer Kletzel, cellist with the Cypress String Quartet, doing a farewell tour of sorts here in the city called Beethoven in the City. Let's talk about that project and why you chose this method of mm-hmm. saying goodbye.
So about a year and a half ago, we were sitting around, I was sitting with our executive director, and we were discussing how we were going to celebrate our 20th anniversary. This is before we knew that the quartet would be ending at that point. And I said, well, wouldn't it be fun to do a pop-up series? I mean, San Francisco is so much about pop-ups, whether it's food trucks or whatever. And then originally we were looking to play them in, typical Bay Area spaces. So you have the Golden Gate Bridge or, Palace of Fine Arts, whatever. And then we began to realize that was going to be complicated to travel all around and do that. And the four of us have lived in San Francisco proper for 20 years. And this has been the city that has hosted us and supported us. And it made sense to, stick around this city. And so once we discovered, I did not know that there are 11 districts, but once we discovered that, we're like, let's put one in each of the 11 districts. And then we'll repeat a couple, there are 16 quartets. So, and then we're big supporters of public art. I think this music, my original title for this, instead of Beethoven to the City, was Beethoven to the People, which was I want to get that music out there. I think that everybody can get something from this music. And so we started the project yesterday. We played at St. Anthony's, the Soup Kitchen, during lunch hour.
And how did that go?
It was amazing. Actually, one of the most moving stories I've heard in a while was someone came up to tell us, the man he was sitting next to, a homeless man who was there for his lunch. He comes every day for lunch. And he just started to cry as we were playing Opus 18 number 1. And the man next to him said, are you okay? And he said, well, I just can't stop crying. You know, I'm homeless. Most of us here are, we don't contribute to society. We don't deserve to hear this. And the patron next to him said, well, of course you do. And this is called grace and mercy, and they're here to share this with you. And to me, that's the reason to do it.
That's fantastic. And today you're performing in a playground.
We are, the West Sunset Playground. Yeah, so, I mean, they're going to be taking us all. We'll be in City Hall. We'll be at San Francisco General Hospital. We'll be at Crissy Field. I mean, it's, you know, it's pretty much, we have a wonderful, on our website, a wonderful Google map where you can see exactly all the locations.
And that website is cypresquartet.com and then Beethoven in the City. But you just go to cypresquartet.com, you get a full sense of the scope of this fantastic Beethoven in the City project of the Cypress String Quartet. Jennifer, we're actually going to go out with Opus 18.
Number six. This is the one we're playing today.
Yeah,
so
there we go. Great. Thanks so much for sharing. And again, cypressquartet.com for more information about the pop-up concerts happening until when?
May 19th is our final one.
So you'll have ample opportunity to catch some free Beethoven. Thanks, Jennifer.
Thanks, David.
Taste of Beethoven for you that'll be popping up around the city. Visit cypressquartet.com for more information. Good afternoon. David LaTulipe here with Open Air, our weekly radio magazine of the performing arts. Still to come, Peter Robinson will share a film and book review, and we'll also talk with Mark Gray, the composer of Frankenstein, which is being performed at the Berkeley Symphony this evening. Well, my next guests are involved in award-winning playwright Garrett John Groeneveld's work The Empty Nesters at Z Below. Pamela Gay Walker is an award-winning actress as well as an accomplished playwright herself, as well as a screenwriter and director for both theater and film. As an actor, her work in film and television includes The Incredibles, a whole slew of other works. She also played Georgia O'Keeffe in Alfred Stieglitz Loves O'Keeffe at FCT in L.A., was Best Actress and Best Production awarded for that. She directed the film Trifles with an all-Pixar cast. There's a big Pixar connection with this family. John Walker is also here with us. He has extensive experience in live theater as well as acting in shows, some 25 shows professionally with his wife, Pam, including college productions. This is the couple's 40th appearance together on stage and their first after a 20-year hiatus. John's other work includes producing the Academy Award-winning Disney Pixar film The Incredibles, and was associate producer for Warner Brothers films Osmosis Jones and The Iron Giant, and he was most recently executive producer for Disney's Tomorrowland, which I'm sure we'll talk about. Pam, John, welcome to Open Air.
Thank you very much.
Thanks,
we're happy
David.
To be
it's
here.
Great to be here.
Boy, this is quite a relationship. We got to talk about that. Acting together for the first time after 20 years, what was that? Reuniting, even though you're living together, you're reuniting on the stage.
For me, it feels like we're home again. This has kind of been a natural progression, and I think I've been very much looking forward to it. So it's a dream come true in a way.
Yeah, it's certainly the way we started our relationship in the theater. We started as actors together, and I proposed to Pam on a curtain call of her Equity debut in a summer stock theater that we both worked in. So we've been a theater family, and we sort of moved both of our careers into the film industry over the last 20 years, and it's been, Pam's always kept working in the theater, but I hadn't really done much of it for a long time, and it was great to get back and you know, be in a theater again, and especially acting with her, which is just a joy. And so it is a homecoming. It's been really great.
And there's themes in The Empty Nesters that really touch home with you guys. But let's talk about the plot a bit of Empty Nesters, if you would.
Okay.
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, this couple that we're playing has just dropped their youngest daughter off at college. And my character especially has been so dedicated to being a mother that she really has lost who she is and all that. And so they really have to discover who they are to each other again, like who are you going to be when your kids grow up kind of thing, and work on some major universal themes that will make one laugh and cry. I don't know. For us, we dropped our oldest daughter out east to college, and I had been processing it for months and months before she left and kind of holding on to my acting career while I was raising the kids, and we made various moves and compromises. And J.W. was in denial about dropping her off, and we went out to Wellesley, and you know, it was a difficult goodbye. For sure. But we were in the parking lot, and it was dark in the evening, and she was supposed to go into her dorm to have a meeting, and she was nervous because she just arrived at college, and he started sobbing in the parking lot because he felt like he was never going to see her again. And Miranda and I looked at each other like, what's happening?
I was like, see you, Mom and Dad, gotta go.
I was too.
It was, women will process these events, I think, more gradually than men, at least more gradually than I did. And I had been so consumed with just, what are the airplane reservations and how do, what are we going to get at Bed Bath and Beyond for her, that I didn't even actually think about the fact that she was not going to be in our home until I was in the parking lot, right? And it just all hit me at once, and I was a basket case. And it reminded me of The Incredibles with E and Elastigirl's sobbing, and she hits her with a newspaper and says, "You are Elastigirl. Put her the stuff together." But that's what my daughter did.
Yeah, I know every parent's experience is different. We were just talking about that earlier, because for us, our girls didn't really rebel, and I was feeling like it was such an unfair process after adoring these people for 18 years that you just drop them off somewhere and say bye-bye. It just seemed really unfair to me. And there are other...
Well, the distance is something.
The distance. It took us all day to get there. She eventually transferred to a school in California, which we were very happy about. But other people, you know, their kids rebel, and you do feel like it's a natural process of letting go, and it's the perfect time to say bye for a while. And after 4 years, their kids come back, and they're different, you know.
So it seems like Garrett wrote your story.
He did. It was really amazing.
It's because... we did it in the festival, the Playground Festival, last year for maybe 10, 11 performances. And when they approached Pam to do the part, and she was sort of like, well, I don't know. And the playwright and the director and
I was busy with other projects.
Yeah, came over
why.
To our house, and they mm-hmm. were, Pam was reading the play with another actor, and I was sitting in the living room just, and I was like, man, that is a really good play.
And so, I kept looking at him and laughing and looking at him and crying. And finally I said, I'd really, really enjoy doing this if you would audition J.W. because he was an actor before. He was a theater and film producer. So they perked up, and a week later they came over and we both read a couple scenes for them. And they said, yeah, let's do it. Since then, we had a very nice run for the festival. And since then, we optioned the play, and we've been working with Richard Side, who's a wonderful director that has worked in the Bay Area for many years, ACT, Berkeley Rep, and now he's been in L.A. for the last 10 or 15 years. So this is his Bay Area premiere after his hiatus, and we workshopped the play with him, so we dug deeper into some of the themes in the play, and he's wonderful with actors, so we did some amazing improv work with him, and we've got a new script, new director.
Yeah, it's been a really interesting, a great creative experience.
Pixar designers, so there's beautiful artwork going on behind us in the show. It's just lovely.
It's really. Pam Walker and J.W. John Walker talking about the Empty Nesters at Z Below on Florida Street through the 11th. Interesting stuff then. John, so prefer J.W. to
either one's fine.
That's fine.
I'll answer to anything.
has the bug been rebitten in your eye then, or is this just a one-off for you?
I love working with Pam. I mean, that's just a joy, and I hope that we can continue to do that. We bought the rights to the play. We have visions of producing it in other cities. I'm working on a movie at Pixar, so that's going to take a couple years. But after that, I think, you know, this might be our annuity. You know, we're going to retire into the theater, become strolling players.
We've talked about it for years.
The Luntz. You'll be the new Luntz.
That was always my dream. Yeah. But we've talked about it for years, and the fact that the play kind of landed in my lap was something sent from heaven or something.
Well, let's shift gears for just a moment and talk about your work at Pixar. You've both been involved with Pixar projects. Mm-hmm. To educate our audience, who I'm sure goes to film after film and sees executive producer and a name flashes and an executive producer and another name flashes and then producers, names flash. What exactly do you do as a producer or executive producer?
Well, you know, it varies per project and per person, obviously. I mean, on Tomorrowland, I was an executive producer, and there were seven.
Which means what? You sit behind a desk more than you run around?
On that particular film.
You write bigger checks.
What I did was work pretty closely with the director and work on second unit. That's what I did on that particular film. But it can be a different thing for every film. The PGA, the Producers Guild of America, has been working very diligently to make the producer credit be one that means something. And you'll see on certain films, a lot of films lately, you'll see a producer credit with a PGA, a little comma PGA after the name, and that means that the Producers Guild sort of certify that person has done what they feel are the tasks that are a producer should do.
Like an equity player.
Kind of, yeah. It's like, it's like a stamp of approval or something.
You know, for Broadway plays, you see like 40 producers getting up at the Tony Awards to accept an award because it's so expensive to produce theater. And people take producer credits for that now. In the old days, they used to call them angels or backers or investors. And so producer credit has become very confusing because everybody takes that as a, you know, as a value chip. So,
well, for the Pixar, you mentioned you're working on a project that's going to take a couple years. Are you allowed to share any of that or at this point?
Not yet. You know, it's always a big fat secret at Pixar for a while. So we're still in the big fat secret
trade
stage.
Secrets. That's fine. In the meantime, catch Pam Walker and JW at Empty Nesters at Florida Street, EmptyNestersPlay.com. It runs through the 11th. Thanks so much for sharing a little bit of your time
today. June, the 11th of June it runs through, yeah.
Oh, 11th of June.
Yes, we open on the 11th of May.
Ah, all right, misread that. Sure. Through June, EmptyNestersPlay.com. Now, I know this isn't one of the tunes in your show, but I thought, you know, given the conflict that no doubt arises year after year and that it's Tammy Wynette's birthday,
okay,
we've got to go out with Stand By Your Man. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Something warm to come to when nights are cold and lonely. Stand by your man and show the world you love him. Keep giving all the love you can. Stand by your man.
Two 200 years ago, a classic piece of literature was conceived, Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, or the modern Prometheus. And composer and San Francisco native Mark Gray has just the ticket to commemorate the event. Mark is an acclaimed sound designer as well as a composer, and his Frankenstein Symphony will have its West Coast premiere this evening as part of the Berklee Symphony's final concert of the 2015-16 season. Critic Josh Cosman already tagged the work as a top five classical pick for the 2016 arts calendar. Mark made his Carnegie Hall debut as a composer with the Kronos Quartet in 2003, and his music has been heard all over the world. He made history as the first sound designer for the New York Philharmonic at Avery Fisher Hall for John Adams' On the Transmigration of Souls in 2002, and at the Metropolitan Opera for contemporary operas Dr. Atomic, Nixon in China, Death of Klinghoffer, all John Adams' works, as well as for more traditional productions of The Merry Widow, Bluebeard's Castle, and Iolanta. It's a pleasure to welcome Mark Gray to talk about his work, Frankenstein Symphony. Hey, Mark.
Thank you for having me.
First off, tonight's big premiere, Frankenstein Symphony, a co-commission with the Atlanta Symphony and Bob Spano. How did that February world premiere go?
Remarkable, actually, and it's always a real treat to experience your music live and being created in that moment. And especially for this work, you know, it being the 200-year anniversary of the conception of the Frankenstein novel, Mary Shelley, at the age of 18, which is remarkable in and of itself, and to see, you know, all of the manifestations the story has taken, all the way to this picture that I'm looking at of Gene Wilder next to me.
Well, we'll talk about
that. Yeah, we will. Sure. Anyways, the symphony is derived from five scenes from the opera I'm writing, Frankenstein, for the La Monnaie Opera House in Brussels.
Well, that is indeed the next big event to come, a full opera on the same topic with Sasha Cooke as Elizabeth among the cast. That must be quite exciting.
Absolutely.
Now, I think we all have some sort of preconceived notions about the Frankenstein story, whether it's Frankenstein and Gene Wilder or Herman Munster.
Yes.
There's lots of baggage there.
Yeah.
Now, is that useful for you, a hindrance or maybe a launching point?
It's actually, for me, I love a good challenge, and so it was a launching point. And really, there is, in the 20th century, we have a lot of visual stereotypes of what Victor Frankenstein looks like and what the creature looks like and all these ideas. Boris Karloff, of course, bolts on the neck, where in the novel actually is quite radically different, very philosophical and very relevant today with gene splicing and drone warfare and
Dolly the sheep. For
yeah, I mean all of these things, and you know, brain transplants that are happening soon, and you know, very very topical. And back then, you know, at that time, galvanism was quite prevalent with a lot of kind of almost like quack doctors in Europe that were going around showing that you could apply electricity to a muscle of a cadaver and, it, you know, the eye would open or the hand would appear, you know, with all fingers moving. And so it's a very, very interesting kind of journey that the story that she created has taken over the 200 years.
So is that the approach you're taking, something that's more authentic to Mary Shelley's story, some of the stuff we may not know from popular culture?
Yeah, and really what we've done is really stepped back into the novel, trying to gather, again, like the morality and the philosophical side of the story, where Victor Frankenstein is essentially like a Faustian character. You know, he has opened this Pandora's box, playing with nature and all of this. But at the same time, the novel is, of course, very Victorian in language, very ornamented. Her husband at the time, she had eloped with Percy Bysshe Shelley. And so, you know, hanging around with the likes of Byron and all of these crazy thinkers and philosophers and writers, it was a challenge to try to, how do we deal with that language and try to set that into a more contemporary lens of an opera. And so what we did was we actually we took the general outline of the story and most of the scenes that are in the novel itself, but set it into actually 200 years in the future from now. So 400 years future from 1816. So,
oh, interesting. Yeah. So we're still discovering Frankenstein, though.
We are
the creature.
What happens? What's so beautiful about the novel is it opens and closes in the Arctic, and you know, in the desolation and in the tundra, and in the middle of it, you have this spark of life. So you have fire. So it's fire and ice that really surround this story, and so our opera, which is starting 400 years after this. You know, Mary Shelley's conception of this work is a group of scientists find the creature in the Arctic, frozen. They thaw the creature and they reanimate the creature. So that's what the actual opera opens with. And then we spend the opera flashing back through the memories of the creature.
Interesting. So is the symphony a sort of Cliff Notes version of the opera, sans singers? Are the instrumentalists taking some of the vocal lines that you've used?
Yeah, it's and that was a challenge in and of itself, trying to adapt. And it's actually remarkable walking into this idea of taking music from an opera and putting it into a symphonic format is there are so many operas and so little operatic music that gets adapted into just orchestra, and you don't see a lot of it. It's mostly overtures from Wagner or Verdi or whatnot. So I decided to really look at why that was the case and try to figure out what were some of the kind of potholes in that road. And what I ended up doing was, yes, taking a lot of most of the vocal music from the scenes, the actual scenes, applied it into the orchestration that was current for the opera. But then what I did was I really embellished and recomposed the orchestration to expand on the theme. So instead of just dropping, say, a melody for Sasha Cooke that might be 8 bars of music into a flute, you know, maybe it's in the horns and then it goes into a flute and then goes to an oboe. So it kind of develops sonically over time.
So are you using a sort of operatic leitmotif for identifying the characters? Will we hear, aha, here's the monster, here's Elizabeth?
There are, yeah. It's some of them are motifs like that, and others are simply kind of constructs of a sound world. So at times when the creature appears, there will be very low strings with very kind of high kind of lightly pulsing strings on top of it. So, yeah, there's kind of textural motifs that come in as well. So, yeah.
So the symphony version is in five movements.
Correct.
Can you give us a little Cliff Notes version of what those movements are going to be telling us?
Sure. The five movements opens with the Genesis, which actually is which opens our opera. Which is the reanimation of the creature. So we have these big chords at the beginning of the work, which kind of symbolize the spark of life. And then it really goes into this very placid place where we start to feel the kind of blood flowing inside of this creature. And slowly over the course of 6 minutes in this movement, we get to another climax, which is actually the creature is alive and now kind of awakening. The second movement, the letter, is... Actually, I wrote it for Sasha because it's this very dreamlike, surreal, beautiful kind of floating architecture, sound architecture that she it just fits her voice so perfectly. And really, the letter is about just to kind of step back a moment. The symphony trying to pull the really critical parts of this opera together as a, instead of 2.5 hours for an opera, we only have 35 minutes for a symphony, was how do I kind of manage that time? And really, the opera has three primary characters, Victor Frankenstein, the creature, and Elizabeth. And it's essentially this kind of crazy love triangle between the three of them, and there's jealousy and rage and terror and all of these things. So I figured it would be very nice to kind of surround that idea and fit it into this symphonic work. So the letter is actually Sasha in the opera singing to Victor, please come home. You know, I love you. Let's get married. Let's start a new life together. She's the Mother Earth. She's the grounding. So we started the first movement, the Genesis, with this, the creature's awakening. Second movement, the letter, with Elizabeth pleading to Victor about her love. We go right into the third movement, which is called the lab, and this is kind of the gore moment. I mean, it's a horror, a horror story. You have to have something in there. So we have Victor in his lab creating a mate for the creature. And as we all know in the story that, basically, because Victor does not create in the first time around the mate for the creature it goes on this binge revenge thing to take Victor completely down. So, third movement, the lab. So it's this kind of machine-like sound that happens in it. Then we go right into the fourth movement, which is called the trial, and the trial is literally is the scene that ends the first act of the opera, and the creature's first kill is actually Victor's youngest brother, William, very, very young brother. And the creature frames Justine, who is the au pair. And so it's Justine's on trial, and the whole courtroom is filled with choristers kind of in the seats, and they're yelling and shouting, and there's a judge, and, you know, Victor's kind of over in the corner, and Elizabeth's pleading. And so it's this kind of really chaotic moment, but kind of rondo in form musically, where it kind of keeps coming back from all the different characters, speaking of leitmotif. Then the last movement is called The Body, and The Body is... the classic opera aria of Victor over Elizabeth's dead body. So ultimately, Victor does not create the mate for the creature. Creature says, well, if you don't create this mate, I will be there on your wedding night, and I will strangle your beautiful Elizabeth.
Lovely.
Yes. It's
well,
a horror story.
I know. Well, speaking of characters, that Victor Frankenstein just can't catch a break. He's like
he can't catch. But, you know, it's his own demise, really. And what's interesting about this movement, The Body, actually, it is a classic, you know, lyric baritone aria. But, you know, in the middle of this aria where he's over Elizabeth's body, crying and sobbing and at the same time, he's saying, but, you know, I am just a really great scientist.
Well, there you go. All right. Well, as long as he's got that,
he's
sunshine.
He's got something going there. So.
Well, his creature resents him. His wife misses him. She's absolutely killed. His brother's killed. Amazing. Talk to me a little bit about the characterizations and your cast. You mentioned that you wrote a lot of the music for Sasha Cooke. Did you have a say in who was going to be cast for the Brussels production?
Yes. And actually, our Victor Frankenstein is Scott Hendricks. And so the role for him is very specific to him and to Sasha as well, being Elizabeth. The creature is a very interesting situation because...
We always have to remember that we think of Frankenstein as the monster, but no, it is a creature and Frankenstein is the doctor.
Exactly. And that's another thing is like the stereotypes of what this story is. It's kind of trying to break the mold a little bit with the opera. Was actually, we originally cast the creature as a mezzo. And because what's very interesting is in the novel, you only have a description of the physicality of the creature, not the sound quality of the creature. So what's interesting is we use this opera, actually, the creature learns language, learns words, learns emotions through music. So it starts, the creature, once it's awake, essentially, and these memories start coming back.
And it's not through putting on the Ritz.
And it's definitely, there's no Igor, you know. but it's a very interesting thing, and I think it uses color of music to actually help set that in. But this creature role is an optional role. It can be either a mezzo or a tenor. So I think we're looking right now at Brussels. It will be a tenor, and it's a...
Maybe it depends on how tightly the bandages are wrapped.
Well, it's exactly, it's a challenging role, and I think in any regard, it's a very challenging role. Just how massive of a character and how much it kind of surrounds the image and stereotype again of the creature is. I felt actually having an option for say presenters 100 years from now to say, well, why don't we try it with a mezzo and see what happens? It's very interesting because you put a mezzo in a very low register, you really feel the earth coming from that voice. And, I think it really resonates through that creature. So,
well, talk to me a little bit about your orchestration. You must have studied and admired the great classical orchestrators, Nikolai Rimsky-Korsakov, Maurice Ravel. Who on the more contemporary side have you found inspiration or new orchestral sounds from?
Right. Well, I've actually been very close with John Adams for about 26 years now. So, and we've worked very closely together. And so I've always been kind of a fly in the wall with a lot of, theatrical productions and orchestra works and the creation of those. And so really firsthand, how a master works in a very intimate setting. And so in a very personal setting. Looking at, you'll hear actually in this symphony, you'll hear Debussy at moments. You'll hear Shostakovich at moments. You'll hear Arvo Pärt at moments. And so it's
maybe a touch of Adams.
And maybe a touch of Adams here and there. A couple repetitions here and there, but not too many. I kind of it's a card catalog when really setting, especially with opera, because they're... You can really shape so many colors and these magical moments and very, mystical, theatrical moments that, passing through the history of orchestration and of composing, you really can find these moments from Bach and Mendelssohn and, just going all the way back, Gesualdo. And, we're looking at, ways in which to thread voice in a music fabric. And so I try to keep it as broad as possible.
I mentioned earlier your sound design work and, as of course, your close rapport with John Adams and his operas. But a sound design for Oklahoma, for Kaija Saariaho's own opera, L'Amour de Loin, what exactly are you contributing when it comes to sound design for these things?
Right. Well, sound design is it's a very kind of elusive title because it has many changing faces in theater and in film and whatnot. And basically where I come into this fabric is I've kind of found this... this world that I'm one of the very few is using technology in opera houses, using sound audio technology in opera houses. And so it's, of course, as we know, most operas don't have sound. And why do they need it? But where we are now is we have, I mean, we're in the 21st century. We live in a digital world. Our ears have changed from 30 years ago, 40 years ago, even 10 years ago. I mean, you know, everybody listening to very high quality music on earbuds. You know, it's the sound has become very intimate with just every, you know, the average person. And so what happens is a lot of contemporary operas, or in this case, a lot of opera companies that are starting to put musicals on their stage, you know, a musical has 70-75% dialogue. You know, and it's like I just came from the Chicago Lyric, where I was doing The King and I, and there's so much dialogue in that work that, you know, it's a 3,800 seat house. It's, you're trying to, you know, hear dialogue from the back seat of this auditorium that's, you know, two thirds of a Chicago city block from the stage. This distance, you need to create some kind of intimacy in there, and so that's where I come in, really, and I help these organizations kind of reevaluate the way in which they present orchestra music with maybe a contemporary work like Kaius Arayaho or John Adams and several others, but you know, also these musicals, because they're at San Francisco Opera, of course, you know, with Showboat and things like that, is it's a way in which to engage a new set of audience and a new, you know, a new generation that's going to be coming to these opera houses.
Well, it sounds fascinating, and I'd love to see some of your work on that front, too. I'm very much looking forward to Frankenstein Symphony. It's tomorrow night with the Berklee Symphony, 8 o'clock, Zellerbach Hall. Best of luck not only with the Berklee Symphony performances, but with the wonderful full production in Brussels coming up.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
That Berklee Symphony concert is tonight at 8, and due to contractual reasons, we aren't able to offer any Mark Gray's excerpt from the Frankenstein Symphony. If you can't catch the Berklee Symphony tonight, tune in on Monday, the 23rd of May, for the Berklee Symphony broadcast of that concert. I'm David LaTulippe, finishing things out with Peter Robinson now on Open Air. Some more Beethoven for you. And to explain why, Peter, why don't you tell us, why are we hearing some of Beethoven's Eroica Symphony?
Well, it's kind of interesting because this week has been very much a French week for me. And the movie that I've just come from last night is called Francophonia. And it's set in Paris. It's the story of the Louvre during the German occupation of Paris in the Second World War. But one of the characters that get introduced into this is Napoleon. And Beethoven had his own reservations about Napoleon. In fact, this symphony changed names originally to this. And it's the type of music which I think personifies, in terms of dual nationality, the German and the French representing different attitudes. So I'll come back to Beethoven in a second, but the movie, I should add, is made by the Russian filmmaker Alexander Sukharov. The film is in three languages. It's in Russian, it's in French, and it's in German. And for the most part, it's also a voiceover. And one of the friends I was seeing the movie with referred to it as a meditation on art. And I think that's a pretty good description because what Zukharov, who also made a movie called The Russian Ark, which was set in the Hermitage Museum, is interested in is what price do we pay for art, not in terms of money, but in terms of commitment, dedication, art for art's sake. So the dilemma that faced the curator and the director of the Louvre during those early wartime years, and it's played by Jacques Giraud, who is the actual director, is played by Louis du Lisansquan, is essentially, do you compromise? And if you compromise, are you selling out your country? The German officer general who is in charge of this is Count Franz Wolf Metternich, who himself was an art historian. And between the two of them together, they come to compromises to preserve the Louvre, not only from bombing and destruction, but also to keep it open. So Francophonia is a story, I think, in many ways, about living under occupation, but there is a second agenda, and the agenda takes us back to the filmmaker Sukharov, who wanted to show what happened in Russia, particularly the various sieges, such as the Siege of Leningrad, where the Russians resisted, as opposed to the French, who under Vichy France compromised. So this, to me, was an interesting film. It is an art historian film. It's a film which puts part of the war in World War II in its context, and at the same time, I think it shows you a good sense of what it is to see the Louvre when a lot of the major works were hidden away in chateaus, in basements, to avoid the destruction.
And how sad it's almost history repeating itself, the way that ISIS has been going after cultural looting, so to speak.
That's absolutely right. And they do have scenes which relate to Syria, where, again, you've seen the destruction of not only religious, but also much of ancient civilization crumbled. So this is an interesting film. I will say it's for art historians, it's for buffs. It is not a war film in the sense that you're studying the occupation, but the occupation is the backdrop. And perhaps that's my one criticism, is that you hear very little, almost nothing, about the Jewish question, which of course raises the question, is art more important than people, particularly in a wartime situation where there has been this compromise. So Napoleon features in the movie, but really as a thief, because you see all the great works of art that he brought back after his campaigns in the Middle East and Egypt, and they are there still today in the Louvre. And not that many other countries aren't better. In Britain, we have the Elgin Marbles, and of course many of the works of art in major museums here have at different points been stolen or taken. Now, if you're interested in that period of history, that is Paris in 1940 to 1945, I would highly recommend a book by Alan First, F-U-R-S-T. He is both a thriller writer, a kind of social historian. The book is called A Hero of France, and it deals specifically with the year 1940, just immediately after the occupation. At this stage of the occupation, the American hospital in Paris was still kept open, and it played a crucial role, because when pilots who had been shot down over France during a bombing raid needed to escape, they would often be taken to the American hospital and then put on an escape line out. And to me, one of the most telling pieces of this story comes at the end, late 1940, 1941. The Germans have used a police chief from Hamburg, who's an old-time policeman. When he wants informers to speak, he offers them coffee. His system doesn't work, and the book ends with the introduction of the Gestapo, and they speak about looking into the cold blue eyes of the Gestapo and suddenly realizing that you have a different regime. So this week for me has been World War II. We've moved from Francophonia, the occupation of Paris, the preservation of artworks in the Louvre, to an excellent thriller by Alan First, A Hero of France. It comes out this month. Excellent read, particularly if you want to refresh your mind what it is like to live under occupation.
Thank you so much, Peter. We'll hear from you again soon.
Good. Good to be here. Thank you.
That's Open Air for this week. Our producer is Niels Swinkels, who handles calendaring and assisting in the production of Open Air. If you've got a show segment suggestion, send me an email, david@kalw.org. Our shows are archived at kalw.org. Look for the Open Air tab. Sending healing thoughts out to Monique Hafen, who is going to be our guest as one of the stars of Sweet Charity down at the Hillbarn Theater. She had an injury that prevented her from being here today. Heal well, Monique, and we wish you a great run of the wonderful Neil Simon classic Sweet Charity down at the Hillbarn Theater through the 29th of May. HillbarnTheater.org for more information. I'm David Latulippe. Thanks so much for tuning in to Open Air here on KLW.